My spiritual director said to me one time, you know, Circle of Grace is like an elephant orphanage. People come who are spiritually wounded and they get healed and they go back to their tribe. Or if they don't feel like they can go back to their tribe, they stay. And so, you know, we have a lot of people who come through who are pretty wounded by the institution. And as they're here and able to claim their own understandings and the way they use language and the way they see stories and the way that they are accepted, they often will move back into the traditions of their youth, being able to take what's good from it and leave behind what they need to.
Connie Tuttle tells her story in her book, A Gracious Heresy, The Queer Calling of an Unlikely Prophet. It's time for Progressive Spirit. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm, and click donate. From the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and Community Global Radio, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Shuck. My guest is Connie Tuttle, Connie Lee Tuttle. She is a pastor of the Circle of Grace, a small progressive ecumenical feminist Christian house church in Atlanta, Georgia. After seminary and before founding the church with a group of spiritual renegades, she directed the Atlanta Hunger Walk and later worked with the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee. She's committed to social justice and has a passion for cooking and providing hospitality. And she's the author of the book that we're going to discuss today, which is really her life, Gracious Heresy, The Queer Calling of an Unlikely Prophet. And she's with me via Skype from Atlanta, Georgia. Connie, welcome to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Okay, I'm going to start with this one. Connie, it's been laid on my heart to tell you that you're going to hell. And I know you're going to laugh because that line came out in the book, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's just lovely. Of all of the piety and the strangeness dripping in that sentence, how did you handle that in your heart when you heard people say that to you?
Well, you know, in my heart, I was at first angry, and I thought that the gentleman was being incredibly arrogant. But I also felt like it was like an opening conversation, and I was, I entered seminary, and this happened in seminary, with this idea that I wanted to hold intention, being both prophetic and being pastoral, because I knew what I was dealing with is that mostly when people talk about sexuality differences, that it's fear-based. I mean, they're afraid of either sin, or they're afraid of themselves, or they're afraid of the other being different and not understanding it. So I went in with this idea that I was going to be really pastoral. So how I responded to that was after I was holding, and while I was holding in my body sort of the meanness of it and the hurt of it, I didn't really feel challenged by it. It never has ever occurred to me in my life that I was going to hell. And at this point in my life, I don't even believe in hell, which is another issue altogether. And I don't think I did then either. So it felt awful, and yet I felt prepared because I'd already made a decision of how I wanted to walk with that kind of attitude.
You know, as I read that sentence, just all kinds of things flooded over me from memories of working with people, or engaging, I guess, as you have, with with this pious veneer laid on my heart. You know, I'm going to pray for you, bless your heart, all of that stuff. And then just the actual meanness and evil and arrogance coming out of the same mouth that talks about all of this pious language about God. It would make anyone, I think, run away from church as fast as they can.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have run away from church as fast as they can. The church was the only context that I had for figuring out this call that I had experienced that I didn't have any way of thinking about it except through the church. And that's a grace and also an ungrace, a challenge. But yeah.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. In your book, you say, "I'm Connie Lee Tuttle. Call me Slumgullion."
Yeah. I'm just a little bit of everything. I think I'm a third culture kid, which is a new term. I was raised overseas in a couple of different contexts. I'm an Army brat. So one of the things I have realized recently is that, like, I lived in the 50s, 60s, and 70s as an Army brat, a very profoundly unusual life in that I lived in a completely integrated culture. And I'm just now going, hey, that wasn't a common experience. And so that gave me a very different way of being in the world and how I even saw this country. That's what I thought America was. It wasn't. and so all of my experiences sort of keep me wide open. I don't know what else to say. I feel like I've had the good fortune of living overseas. I've had the good fortune of living all over this country, south, north, the Pacific Northwest, the West in general. And all of that, you know, you can't be exposed to all kinds of things and be a part of all different kinds of communities and not have it keep you open. Otherwise, I would shut down to all kinds of things about myself.
You know, one thing I noticed in reading your book, that you're very transparent about yourself, about your life, but I didn't notice a lot of self-doubt about being a lesbian. In other words, maybe you did, but I didn't see that in terms of you certainly battled on with other people who wanted to put you in a box and make that identity something, but you never for yourself, or did you? Say, God, why did you make me this way? And wrestle with all of the oftentimes self incrimination. Take it within the accusations of not being with God and all of that.
Yeah, one of the things I say is sometimes I feel like I slap around in this big old puddle of grace. I think I might have put this in the book. When I came out, like, there was a part of me that was like singing the doxology inside, that was saying, thank you, God, for like letting me figure out who I am. This is great. So that is the grace I think that I offer people who, as a pastor and as a friend and as just a person in the world, that you can exist without that horrific, not only self-doubt, but I often find people have self-hatred. And that feels sort of anti-God. So yeah, I didn't have that, and I have no explanation for it. At some point I thought, well, maybe I'm just like a sociopath and I don't, you know, I don't have those feelings of guilt, but that's not true, because I have feelings of guilt about lots of things, but not about who I am. Much more about poor choices in my behavior towards other people, or times that I have lacked compassion, or, you know, those kinds of things I feel really bad about. But about me, that's just not been a part of my story.
I'm speaking with Connie Tuttle, if you're just joining us. She's a minister and the author of A Gracious Heresy, The Queer Calling of an Unlikely Prophet. Throughout the book, you speak easily and to me, and this is something I envy. You speak easily of God. Can you tell me about your experience of God? How you happened to come to know who God is early on?
God was never an old man sitting in a cloud to me. There was always something very experiential about God. I probably would have been a great Celtic Christian as a child, you know, that I experienced God in the entire world around me, and people, and in the concept of love. And I have to hand that to my mom, to the women in my life, who really modeled for me that no one is outside of God's love, and that that is the first and the final and the test for everything is the action loving, not as a feeling, but as just and kind. And I don't feel like it's loving just parenthetically to have something laid on your heart to tell someone they're going to hell. That is not loving, although I think he would have said that was. Mm-hmm. So I was just had this this freedom to experience God. And the other thing that happened is, I know I was a kid that asked a lot of questions. And I also know that nobody in my family tried to give me an answer. And so that also freed me up a great deal. Or if I went off down a path that I wasn't jerked back, you know, I can remember having a conversation with my mom once saying, I heard human beings are animals. I was maybe 4 or 5. And she said, yep. And I said, wow, well, then I want to be a deer. No, wait a minute. I want to be a skunk. No, wait a minute. I want. And she never like called me back and said, no, that's not what it means to be an animal. She let that kind of let me ride off on my imagination. I guess she figured I'd learn sooner or later that I wasn't going to be a deer. But there was a freedom in how God was just an everyday part of our lives.
And he really, the relationship with your parents too, seemed as you're just talking there, but even when you take the moment at some point later on, you come out to them, you tell them who you are, that you're gay, and you're worried about it, but it's almost like a non-issue. Or is it? When you told your parents, was that what was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, the issue for them was that they had to figure it out what it meant, but it was never the issue of, are we going to love you? Or are we going to accept you? I think that for my dad, there was a moment of, what does this mean for my grandchild? Like, is this, you know, is this going to be bad for my grandchild, with my daughter? Always there was not the question of whether or not they would love me. I asked my mom, who was definitely the more churched person. My dad didn't go to church. if she wanted me to give her resources to read, and she said yes. But I will also say she moved up and lived with me for like 13 years before she passed away. And in that time, we had a really good transgender friend who had a horrific bicycle accident and broke her hip. And my mom said, well, she needs to be on the first floor, so let her come stay with me. And they lived together there for 9 months while our friend was healing. And that was never a question for her. So again, her attitude toward me, her attitude toward all these things, even like in her 80s and 90s, that were not something she grew up thinking about or knowing about, was the test is love. Am I loving this person? And God will sort out the rest of it.
You, I'll talk about the vows you made when you were baptized. And you said that the vows I made were not casual vows. Can you talk about that? The vows that you are about as a minister, and you kind of had to learn this in a sense from, I don't know, is this right, from a vacuum almost? I mean, it wasn't like it was a lot of church instruction about all of this, or was there?
Well, you know, yes and no. I went to church as a child every Sunday, but we went to the church that was on post, and whatever the tradition of that minister was how we worshiped. And Sunday school was, you know, wonderful and good, and I learned the stories, and but it had to be okay, inclusive of everyone, of all the kids there, so that it didn't tend to be incredibly doctrinal. So yeah, I was churched. I mean, I was in church all the time. I did not miss a Sunday, but it was not a denominational experience of church. And so there wasn't the heavy duty doctrine. We were there for a different reason. And I forgot your question, John.
Well, you know, my question really was, is that it's your call not only for your baptism, but to be a minister, came out of a real issues of justice, and I'm always curious where you I was when reading, and where did you get all of that? How did you become a feminist and know about racism and recognize it right away? There was all the way through. You have an aspect of being baptized. That was the passage was on baptism, but it was actually for you as an understanding, you know, not of being saved or whatever, but really of being a person of integrity and working for the good of the world.
Well, that's a really good question, and it's a really hard question. I'll try to answer it. You know, I have to go back to my mom and that idea of justice and love, you know, are completely intertwined. If you care for someone, then they cannot be mistreated. And then from my dad, who, you know, he was a World War II vet and a Korean War vet, and the way he saw the world after, you know, being years in combat, was that the reason he was there was to fight evil, and truly the evil of the Holocaust. And so somehow that all got meshed together for me, that to be faithful had to do with loving and standing against evil, which I think comes together as justice.
You know, when you write about your struggles with the seminary and the the ecclesiastical authorities. I was so depressed about again about how shallow they all were. I mean, you know, it's so obvious that you bring to this. I mean, the difference between being, and you write this in the book, about being pious and being righteous. You know, tell me about that. Do you know what I'm talking about? That pious and righteous. I remember when you was in school, when a professor was telling you about the choices, how we can be in life, and certainly the professors and all of that kind. Not all of them, of course, but so many of them so concerned with the piety part of it. And you're saying, hey, you know, why don't you ask me questions about, you know, justice?
Right. Yeah. That was, you know, it's really hard when the people who you expect to admire, and I came almost as a supplicant because I was just hungry for learning, and to encounter the clay-footedness of piety. I think piety, and I'm probably not being fair here, but like, I don't know where it gets you. I just don't. I don't know what the spiritual payoff is for being pious. I think it turns other people off. I think it makes you deny your humanity. I know, as I'm saying that out loud, I know it's not fair, but that's just my feeling stuff. But being righteous is like doing all the stuff Jesus did. Being righteous is, you know, like bringing children to you, and it's about embracing lepers, and it's about forgiving people and embracing people whose sins have appeared to be sexual and challenging cultural norms. That that's the kind of righteousness I was expecting from the institution. Now I've matured a little bit since then, and I understand that, you know, institutions necessarily have to perpetuate themselves or not, but but yes, I was astounded by this, and again, this is probably has to do with not having been raised in a denomination. Had that happened, I may have had a very different understanding of it.
Well, you know, that might make you far more interesting. I mean, had you been raised, you might have just been beaten down by it. I mean, this, you called out the president, you know, your concern is economics. If you let me stay here, graduate from here, you're afraid of financial giving to this institution will suffer. And I was like, yeah, you said it. How did that feel to say it?
Oh, well, it felt two ways. Inside, like I was shaking like a leaf. And outside, I was trying to be pastoral and prophetic, that conundrum again.
Uh-huh.
I didn't say it. I said it sort of in a, not in a deeply, it was confronted by just the words. But I wasn't jumping up and down at the table. I was saying, you know, I think that the issue here isn't my morality. It is your financial concerns, or however I put it. But I think speaking truth to power, which, and they had the power to kick me out or whatever, was pretty scary, and yet I felt like needed to say what needed to be said. Now, I later found out that they wouldn't have kicked me out because they were afraid I was going to sue them if they did, which was the farthest thing from my mind. I was walking through this, you know, with just assuming everything was what it appeared to be.
Yeah. Well, that makes me even feel worse about them. You know, as I'm just thinking of these institutions and all that you went, I mean, having to meet with the president every day and or every week or whatever, and all of this stuff and all being about you and all being about this one part of you that isn't all of you, and people thinking of it all the time. But you had an impact. You had an incredible impact. In fact, I want to talk about one of the metaphors one of your professors said about being a stone being tossed into the pond. You'll sink to the bottom, not knowing the ripples you've caused to reach the shore. But you have seen some of those ripples, haven't you?
I really have. I really have. And I know at the end of the book that I talk about the 223rd General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church affirming LGBTQAI, et cetera, into full inclusion of the church, which I find astounding, 20 how many ever years later, almost 30. But I'll tell you a story that's not in the book. After the book came out, I met with a woman who is now employed at Columbia Seminary. And she said, you know, I'd really like you to come and do a chapel one Wednesday. We have something called a forum. It's an informal worship service. And you could, you know, as long as we pray and sing a little bit, you can do a reading of your book. And I'd like you to come. Now, there's only about 10 or 12 people who show up, but that's, you know, I just think it would be important. I said, I would love to. That would be great. Well, 50 people came, which was also great. And they now have at Columbia Seminary many LGBT students there who are open and affirmed, and they may not get jobs, but they're the next wave. At the end of the forum, the president of the seminary was there, and she stood up and she said, may I say something? And I said, absolutely, of course. And she said, I wasn't here when you were here, but I'd like to say on behalf of this institution, I am so sorry for what we put you through.
Wow.
I could never have imagined that day or that response.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Connie Tuttle, author of A Gracious Heresy, The Queer Calling of an Unlikely Prophet. More to come. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. You're listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Connie Tuttle, author of A Gracious Heresy, The Queer Calling of an Unlikely Prophet. Yeah, you went through this struggle at seminary in the 80s when a lot of this conversation was fairly new within the church and fairly... silence this right away. And so you and the beauty of what you were doing is that there's a I don't know if it's a naivete, but it was, I don't think it's that, but it was like, here I am and this is my call, and yeah, I'm not gonna be silent about who I am. I'm not gonna, you know, necessarily parade it. I think that's what you wrote that, but I'm not gonna just keep it quiet either. And I think that reverberated beyond your own self into the life of the church and the seminary. You really were a pebble that has made some ripples, and they're still going.
Well, thank you for that. I think I also say, you know, that being called to be faithful doesn't ever guarantee measurable outcomes, and sometimes I felt like that it never made any difference in the world. And that was on the hard days. But I think you're right. I think that there have been some, there was a pebble dropped, and there are some ripples that went to shore. And just to follow up on the naivete, you actually have that right. And I still at this ancient age, find myself to be naive on many things, and so I just have to claim that. I don't think you're wrong about that.
Well, I think there's some, we call it naive, but I think it's really being a person of integrity, you know, and just saying what's real despite the opposition. Right at the very beginning of the book, there's a cynicism and hope. I mean, and we have that within ourselves, right? On one level, when we're facing in the battle, we get cynical and we get hope within the same minute sometimes. Do you still go through that?
Yes, I do. I think it's, you know, I do talk about in the book about the Enneagram and that I'm a 4 on the Enneagram, and one of our challenges,
what's that mean? Are you going to tell what is a 4?
An Enneagram is an ancient system that a Christian mystic came up with that is now still used in Christian spirituality, that has a number on a wheel, and it's very complicated, but basically it's based on what it is that motivates you, so that you know yourself, what it is that motivates you, and then how to act and work towards a redemptive way of being who you are, not to be somebody else, but to be it in a redemptive way. And so my challenge is that the Enneagram and that I resonate with is that I struggle with not feeling like I am enough. Enough of a good pastor, enough of a good, you know, writer, enough of a good mom, all of those not enough things. And that, so that's still my challenge. And in the moments that I am centered and in my redeemed self, I recognize that I'm enough, and that what I have done is enough, and what I'm am doing is enough. And that is my challenge.
Yeah, and saying that is helpful for those of us who read it, who go through these same kinds of things, but don't have a name to put on it, you know. And that provides permission to feel however it is we feel, as well as, hey, here's another person who's been on the journey with me, and she's done this. Maybe I can too.
Well, I would hope it would offer, you know, my hope is really that the story can offer grace, because this world is in sad need of grace, and grace for ourselves, as well as extending grace to, you know, all of those around us.
Your book is called, the house church is called Circle of Grace. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we are heading into our 26th year, and we have morphed and changed all over the years. It began after I got out of seminary, and I was doing social justice work, but I'm just not an administrator. That's not my gift, and it's not my call. And so I was trying to figure it out, and I put up some flyers, and I started teaching just with groups of people who would come in, women at this point, on Christian feminist theology and spirituality. And I did it, you know, several times over several months. And some of the folks came back and said, we don't want to just talk about this. We want to do this. And so we got together and decided how we were going to do it. One of the first things we did when we talk about Circle of Grace was say, how do we name ourselves if naming is important? And the circle piece was as important as the grace piece. The circle piece was that we were going to be non-hierarchical, that everybody had a place in the circle, and we may have different gifts and we may bring different things to the table, but that the power of the community would be shared. And that was a very important part to me, to be a point on the circle rather than the center or the, you know, in some kind of pyramid pattern. And the other was grace. And the conversation was, you know, if everyone was welcome, who would not be welcome? You know, and we went through it. And what if this person came? What if a Nazi came? You know, what if someone came who was naked? What if some, you know, all these kind of, we just brainstormed, would anybody not be welcome? To the point that if someone came who was naked, we always had someone who had a blanket in the back of the car. We did never have a naked person show up, but we were ready so that no one would feel unwelcome. And even though it was really painful for us to say, what about a Nazi? What about a child molester? Decision was, as long as they were not disruptive of the service of the community, that there would be always a place at the table. And we had that challenged in different ways. And I'm going to tell that story, in the book I'm working on now, about some of the different challenges that, and graces that the community experienced.
So you're working on a book that kind of goes after this book, A Gracious Heresy?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll probe a little bit. So you have been 26 years with this community.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. So and you say it's a house, it's meaning you don't have a building or?
No, we don't have a building, and we've never been large. I mean, I think at our largest, we were between 25 and 30 worshiping every Sunday. At our smallest, we were probably 3, and we said, you know, we're never 3 or more gathered together. Right now, we hover between 8 and 10. It changes. Actually, the working title of my next book is Circling Grace, Tales from an Elephant Orphanage. And my spiritual director said to me one time, you know, Circle of Grace is like an elephant orphanage. People come who are spiritually wounded, and they get healed and they go back to their tribe. Or if they don't feel like they can go back to their tribe, they stay. And so, you know, we have a lot of people who come through who are pretty wounded by the institution. And as they're here and able to claim their own understandings and the way they use language and the way they see stories and the way that they are accepted, they often will move back into the traditions of their youth, being able to take what's good from it and leave behind what they need to.
A friend of mine is a Unitarian Universalist minister, and she said similar things about the community that she pastors, that it's kind of sometimes collects people from, you know, who've been alienated from whatever tradition, and some stay and some go, depending on what they need. It's a place of, for some, a sojourn, for some, it becomes a permanent home, too. So, you know, I have to, as a Presbyterian minister and a person of privilege in all ways, I find myself feeling very sad that our denomination spent so long denying justice, and we lost so many qualified people, rejecting them from the church, sometimes just in such a mean way. Not only that, but and so now the church, well, says, okay, everybody's in again. Do you keep up with the Presbyterian Church? How do you feel about that, really?
Actually, you know, I do. I have friends who are ministers in the Presbyterian Church. I have friends who are Christian educators. I have friends who just attend Presbyterian churches. I have friends who attend Presbyterian churches and then occasionally come and worship with us. So, yeah, I do keep up with the Presbyterian church because I feel like my story is also a part of their story. And their story is a part of mine. And so I have had someone say, well, now would you go back and would you be ordained in the Presbyterian church? And at this moment in my life, I'm saying, well, no, because I don't know that after all these years that I would work well within an institutional structure. Because a lot of what I do is theological exploration and liturgical exploration, and I don't know if I would have the freedom to do that. So I don't have a resentment about it, except, and I will say this, except that, you know, I won't have any retirement, mm-hmm. which had I had that, been able to be working in ministry in the Presbyterian Church, I might have been able to retire. And now I'm thinking that my call is just to walk until I can't walk anymore. So, I'm saying that as a joke. It is the only thing at this stage of my life that I go, yeah, it would have been a little easier had I had a retirement plan.
Connie Tuttle, author of A Gracious Heresy, The Queer Calling of an Unlikely Prophet. Tell me about being a prophet. What is a prophet?
Well, you know, a prophet is somebody who just won't shut up. A prophet is somebody who stands for the oppressed and for the righteous and who is willing to take onto their own bodies what is necessary to speak and stand for God. And that makes me sound better than I am. One of the things I say is, you know, I when I talk about prophets, there are great prophets who have changed the course of history. I mean, there really are. And I think we could probably agree that Martin Luther King Jr. is one of them and that Nelson Mandela is one of them. I am not. I am not that kind of a prophet. But in whatever my sphere has been, I have done the standing and the speaking. And so that's what I mean. That and there is this impelling. There's something about my relationship with God that won't let me shut up. When I was ordained by Circle of Grace, and my mentor from seminary preached the sermon, I asked him to preach from Jeremiah, where he said, you know, I just don't want to do this anymore, but there's a fire in me and I can't shut up. So to me, that not being able to shut up may be what it means to be a prophet for me.
You know, theologian Matthew Fox talks about recognizing that we all are prophets. We're all artists too. And we, as you said, and you say in the book too, it's not about doing a great work, but a million small tasks that the prophetic call is that nudge within us to be that holy fool sometimes, isn't it? I mean, to go out and stand up to the president and say, hey, this is about economics, guy. I know you. Yeah. You know, and even though it would be, everybody would say, oh, don't do that. That's kind of it, but that we have to, we all have that urge and so we just need to act on it sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell me about Howard Thurman, Jesus and the Disinherited.
Wow. Well, you know, that intersects with my call. I had this very frightening and persistent mystical experience that I interpreted as call. And so I went out everywhere I went. I was like asking anybody who I met somebody going to seminary. I met somebody in a church. I like, what does this mean? I don't know what to do with it. And Interestingly enough, the feminist bookstore here in Atlanta, which is Charis Books and More, and as a Presbyterian, you will recognize Charis as the Greek for grace. Two of the members, the founders of them, were women in seminary at the time, which I find graceful and interesting. But one of them I went to and I said, okay, I'm trying to figure this out. And she handed me a copy of Jesus and the Disinherited and said, maybe you need to look at this. And I don't know that I've ever put it back down, because it speaks to me every day in a profound way. How to deal with, I mean, it's very simple. He talks about love, hate, fear, Jesus, and in such profound and insightful ways that, you know, when I'm feeling afraid, sometimes I'll go back and read that chapter on fear. And when I'm having a hard time loving someone, and I'm thinking about now in our political climate, I go back and read that. And it helps me discern and know that love is not a feeling. Love is, as I said, and he says, the activity of justice. And fear is the way that we are quieted, that our prophetic voice is quieted, and that our self-hatred is nurtured. And so being afraid is something that I have to challenge all the time, and I think all of us do. But if your listeners haven't read Howard Thurman's Jesus and the Disinherited, I cannot recommend it highly enough. He was a loving prophetic voice and a true scholar that I will continue to admire for the rest of my life.
Well, that, obviously that stuck out for me when I read your book. I have his work too, and appreciated that book. And as Christmas comes, all of this mood of Christmas, he has such a lot of beautiful Christmas Advent poetry as well.
Yes.
About grace and justice. We're getting close to the end, but I also want you to tell me about being a writer. This is a beautifully written book, And was it when you were in trouble? That's what I thought was the irony. I think when one of your teachers got in trouble, had to write an essay, and then your teacher said you should be a writer. Can you tell us about that story?
Yes. I got in trouble, and I wrote this. I was told to write this essay of 1,000 words. I was in seventh grade or eighth grade, I think, and I was so morally indignant. And the first thing I was going like, 1,000 words, oh my God, because when you're at that age, 1,000 words seems like forever. But I was so furious, and I had this righteous indignation, and I went home, and boy, I think I churned out probably 1,200-1,300 words, and I took it into her, and I must have argued my point well. It didn't mean I wasn't still in trouble, but yeah, it was an affirmation more than a punishment, for sure. And it was also like made me recognize that I had a voice, and that I could think and reason and use it and use my passion in my writing. Now, I say that at my age now, I think that was a revelation that happened over time. But yes.
Well, you know, and it also, as I read that, spoke of the importance of teachers and administrators and the wise ones who recognized that and who did that and who affirmed that, of all of the different kinds of choices an administrator might make then, but to actually take the time to recognize your gift and have that be a moment for you. That's so important for teachers or ministers, isn't it, of the effects that we have on people.
Yes, and it's one of those places where I recognize where there are things I've done and said that have been graceful for others. It's also where I agonize where I know that I have really screwed up, not intentionally, but that I have said things or done things that have not given the kind of encouragement that would have made a difference in someone's life.
Well, the heart of being a prophet is kind of having, someone said, a thinness of the soul too. We're hard on ourselves too, as we are, as we deal with all of that. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with the feeling bad about yourself?
Well, I'm not sure I know the answer to that, John. I think that I have to, my centering prayer, I think I blogged about this recently, can be when I'm screaming in traffic and I have to take a breath and go, okay, how can I love that person? I think that when I'm feeling that way, it's like, how can I accept myself, know who I am, and move forward in a different way? I think that's the best that I can do sometimes. And I can do that because I also think that that the sacred accepts me and invites me to accept myself and also encourages me to move forward in a different way, in a more redemptive way. And
I asked you a whole lot of personal questions, and I did so. I probably just because I find you to be very gracious and pastoral and a prophet and a person you can talk to, all of those wonderful things. And it comes out in your book, A Gracious Heresy, The Queer Calling of an Unlikely Prophet, Connie L. Tuttle, Connie Lee Tuttle, as we say in Tennessee or Georgia.
Yes.
And also you have a, tell me about your blog. You also have a website.
I do, and I blog every week. It's called The Gracious Heretic, thegraciousheretic.com. And I blog about politics, spirituality, justice.
Stuff that matters.
Stuff that matters, at least that matters to me and that I think should matter to everybody. There's my should statement for the day.
All right. And we'll go with that. Connie Tuttle, thank you so much for all your important work and for hanging in there and for standing up at that presbytery meeting and staying stood up, even though they did that vote against you. It was impressive. And so you stood up for a lot of people in doing that. Thank you so much for being with me today.
John, thank you for having me, and thank you so much for the work you do. It is more important than you probably recognize.
The website is progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck. Be well.